As publisher of Talkers Magazine and a go-to source for reporters writing stories about talk radio, one of the most frequently asked questions that I encounter is why hasn't liberal talk radio been able to enjoy anywhere near the same level of success since the late 1980s as conservative talk radio on the commercial radio dial? It's a question not easily answered, although I have my own theories on the subject. Is there a conservative political bias on the part of station owners? Are conservative talk show hosts more talented than their liberal counterparts? Does it have anything to do with the nature and breakdown of the available listeners for each approach? Are liberals and conservatives wired differently? Are conservative audiences more targetable than liberals from the perspective of radio programming? Are liberals more likely to listen to a conservative host on the radio than conservatives are willing to listen to a liberal? Do conservatives more readily support commercial talk radio because they believe the rest of what is loosely termed the mainstream media is overwhelmingly biased toward liberalism? There are varying degrees of truth to each of these propositions, some more so than others. Stand by for a fascinating conversation that'll explore these questions and more about the state of talk media and politics as we approach the 2020 presidential election. Our guest this week is one of the major names and players in commercial liberal talk radio, or as some call it, progressive talk radio. He's a pioneer known to audiences of both cable news television and on-air as well as online progressive talk radio. He's also a prolific author who writes about the virtues of the Democrats and the left and the dangers of Donald Trump, conservative politics, and right-wing talk radio. On the TV side, this groundbreaker was co-host of CNN's legendary debate program, Crossfire, from 1996 to 2002, and then he went on to do several shows beyond that on cable TV. Today, he's a regular talking head on MSNBC as well as CNN. He's also an opinion contributor to the D.C.-based political publication, The Hill. And he announced last week that he's about to conclude his daily morning radio talk program that has been heard for the past 14 years on a variety of terrestrial and online platforms and has attracted a respectable critical mass of loyal listeners. In its place, he'll be devoting his energies to podcasting and has every intention of continuing to be an active voice in the national conversation as we work our way toward Election Day 2020. Our guest this week is distinguished broadcaster, journalist, and political pundit, Bill Press. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Interview, the weekly podcast from Podcast One for media freaks, pop culture aficionados, political junkies, and the philosophically curious. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, and the Podcast One app, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We'll dive right into our conversation with Bill Press, but first, a real quick programming reminder. If you like this show, you're going to love the Laura Ingraham Show podcast on Podcast One. Join Laura as she takes on politics and pop culture with some hard-hitting guests and takes your calls. Download the Laura Ingraham Show podcast every week on Podcast One or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Okay, here we go. An uninterrupted conversation with multi-platform media commentator Bill Press. So, Bill, what's going on with your radio show? That's been a bit of a buzz in the industry. 14 years, one of the handful of progressives anywhere near terrestrial commercial radio. And you got some plans. So what's the exact update on that?
I've been at it after Crossfire on CNN and Spin Room on CNN. That Pat Buchanan and I moved over to MSNBC, and we did a show there called Buchanan and Press. And then that was 14 years ago when that show ended, and I began my show, The Bill Press Show, first 3 hours every morning and then 2 hours every morning, out in that lonely field of progressive talk radio. I just decided that 14 years was a good long run, and it was time to move on to the next transition or the next phase. By the way, Michael, I checked this morning. The average marriage in the United States lasts 8.2 years, right? The average college president is in office for 6.5 years. The average member of Congress for 9.1 years. So I've exceeded all of that.
Well, you've you've also exceeded all of that in terms of the totality of your media career. I mean, you've been a professional media person between being a reporter and being a television broadcaster and a radio broadcaster for about half the time that radio has been in existence. So, you're a half century
in. I actually started on KABC-TV in Los Angeles in September 1980. And within about 6 months, I was also appearing on KABC Radio in Los Angeles, and then I moved over to KFI. But what I'm going to be doing next, and Michael, I credit you for part of this, I'm going to be joining the world of podcasts, which is where more and more people who love talk radio or do talk radio are moving. And I'm going to be starting that the very first week of June. And I just want the world to know the first person I talked to about podcasts and gave me a lot of good advice about how important it was and how to get into it is Michael Harrison. So I thank you again, and I have followed your direction as closely as I could.
Well, obviously through podcasting and through the specialized media of the 21st century, which you are quite adept at executing, you're going to be able to get to those people that do want to follow you. You've built a following brick by brick, which is the way it's done in this modern era. Every listener counts. Every listener is a relationship. And you have a voice that should be heard. Not to mention, I can't imagine a guy like you sitting out the 2020 election. I mean, this one is just going to be juicy.
It is, I think, and as we just discussed, I've been through a lot of them. Starting in 1976 when I worked in Jerry Brown's first presidential campaign, but I've never been more excited about a Democratic presidential primary than this one, because there's just something for everybody. It's like shopping at Walmart, right? I mean, you've got 24 Democratic candidates as of this count. It could be 25 by the end of the week. And you've got something for everybody. I mean, male and female and black and white and Asian and American and Latino and gay and straight, left of center or far left. It's a great group of people. A lot of important issues that are being discussed and proposed. And I think it's going to be exciting all the way up to the convention and then into the general election. By the way, I also think on a serious matter that we say this every 4 years, I really believe there is more at stake in this election than ever before. You know, it is the environment, it is education, it is foreign policy, it is immigration, it is health care. I think it's the basic tenets of our democracy. And it's the Supreme Court all on the line in 2020.
Don't you hate saying that, even though it's true every election, that this is the most important election of all time? I always cringe. I hate saying it, too.
Yeah.
But there's something funny about the now. You know, this is philosophical. You know, the here and the now always trumps, if you'll pardon the expression, anything that's happened in the past. We're so immersed in the now. And it does feel that way. And I guess if you really look at it analytically, it's correct. This election is the most important. We got so much at stake, but it always feels that way. And sometimes it feels almost like a cliche to say it, but it should be said. You know what I mean?
No, I honestly believe you're right. I cringe when I hear myself saying it. Mm-hmm. But I must say that the choice between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, right, or George Bush and Al Gore, as strongly as I felt about those choices, they pale in comparison to the stark difference between Donald Trump and whomever.
And whomever.
I think we could have survived a Mitt Romney, right? We certainly survived a George W. Bush. I honestly, I hate to make this a political talk, but I'll just tell you my opinion is I'm not sure this country can survive 4 more years of Donald Trump and be who we are.
I think the "and be who we are" is the key to that, because some people are saying, hey, everybody thought the world would end when Donald Trump became president. We're 2.5 years into it. The economy is doing well. We haven't really, as of this moment, escalated any kind of dangerous war. We were on the brink of war with North Korea, a couple of madmen, Donald Trump and Kim, you know, lobbing their big buttons at each other and all that stuff. How do you feel about the fact that a case could be made that a lot of the disaster, the gloom and doom of Trump is rhetorical, but that if you look at the stats, things are not so terrible?
I don't agree with that at all. I mean, certainly the economy, give credit where credit is due, the economy has remained strong, and in fact has grown stronger for those people who have benefited from it. Most Americans have not seen either their standard of living rise or their incomes or wages rise. But the economy has remained pretty strong, thanks, I think, to the robust economic recovery started by Barack Obama. I mean, it is a fact. We've been 10 years into this economic recovery. 8 of it was under Obama, 2 of it now under Donald Trump. But if you look at other areas where we have lost in terms of our standing in the world, in terms of going totally backwards in addressing the issue of climate change, which I think is the greatest threat facing the planet, we are in a, most people don't talk about this, we are in a war, not a war, I should say, in a rush right now to escalate and increase the number of nuclear weapons that we have, when other presidents, Republican and Democrat, were all focused on reducing the nuclear threat in this world. Donald Trump has turned the corner on that in terms of our immigration policies. I think in many ways we've lost our soul. Mm-hmm. We've seen this rush now to take away reproductive rights from American women, which most Republicans had even walked away from. Donald Trump has emboldened the extreme right, and they're moving to do away with Roe v. Wade, and we're one court case away from that. So I think in many, many important ways we have gone, we're rushing backwards under Donald Trump, and I'm worried about it.
Now, you mentioned earlier, and I mentioned earlier, that you're one of the only, well, only is a strong word, you're one of a handful relative to the number of people in commercial news talk radio who have turned it into a phenomenon over the past 25, 30 years from the conservative side of ideology. One of the questions I'm asked as somebody who is a go-to guy in the media about talk media and talk radio, and I'm sure you're asked it all the time, and it's a major question, and I know the answers are many and complicated, but I have to throw this at you. Why do you think it has been so difficult in a country that is basically split down the middle? That's why we call it polarized. Why has it been so difficult over the years for the progressive brand of talk radio to really get traction on commercial radio stations in the commercial talk radio industry?
Well, that is an issue you and I have talked about many times. That's an issue that I wrote a book about a few years ago called Toxic Talk. As you point out, by the way, it is one of the great frustrations of my life, because I so believe in progressive talk radio, not to see it do better, not to see it really thrive, and today, in fact, almost see it wither and die on the vine. Let me say, first of all, it is not because of a lack of talent. I mean, I'd put up Tom Hartman and, God rest his soul, Ed Schultz and Stephanie, and when in his time, and Stephanie Miller and others, as good as anybody else on the conservative brand, if not better. But I think the factors are these. Number one, I would say, number two, number three, number four, number five, maybe ownership. I mean, the Republicans, the conservatives, I should say, they were very smart. They recognized the importance of having a strong message machine from the very beginning, going back to the memo that then attorney Lewis Powell, who later became Supreme Court Justice, wrote for Richard Nixon about how conservatives could take over the American political process. They followed his advice. They went out. They bought stations. They created networks. They developed their talent. They put the money into it, where progressives and liberals simply did not. So they ended up owning the stations, and you could have, as you know, four or five stations in the same market, but they'd all be owned by a conservatives, and they would all put the same people, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, Mark Levin, and all the rest on the air, and provide no voices for progressives. And they were able to do so, of course, I should mention, because of the cancellation, if you will, of the overturning of the fairness doctrine. So I think that it's mainly a question of ownership. I mean, I could compete. Tom Hartman's been able to compete. Others have been able. Ed Schultz able to compete against anybody on the same time zone in the same market if they're on the air. But if they're not, if we're not on the air, you can't compete. It just.
Do you think that we could ever get back to the day when one platform, one radio station could appeal to a cross-section of people who enjoy debate and enjoy talk and have different points of view? Or are we hopelessly mired in the target audience preaching to a choir style of doing business in radio?
I would be happy to be proven wrong, but I think I think that day is come and gone. Just like in the 21st century, more and more people are abandoning appointment talk radio to listen to podcasts whenever they want, at any time of day, wherever they are. I think going back to a station like when I started at KABC Radio in Los Angeles and KGO Radio in San Francisco was the same way. I did some work there where you had a mix of voices during the day and night. Which I thought was very, very healthy. I don't think we ever go back there, Mike.
Right, let me circle back now to you were answering my question about why liberal talk radio doesn't work, and you only made one point, and I interrupted you. So go back to some of the other points that you were about to bring up.
Well, just one other point I was going to make is that there's something about progressives, I'm not afraid to use the word liberal, that is different from conservatives, and that is. A lot of liberals like to hear different, more points of view, or they want to hear the facts, or they want to hear the arguments. And so I always found, you know, we progressives lost a lot of our audience by people who'd rather listen to NPR. Not that that's bad, but it's just something about their makeup, right? They don't want to hear just people that they agree with all the time, as opposed to right-wingers who... That's all they want. They just want the echo chamber. They want to get the fix. And that's very, very real. And they get it, of course, from Rush or Sean Hannity or anybody else, and never hear a dissenting point of view.
What about that?
I find myself, I'm guilty of that. Yeah. You know, I'll tune into Fox or I'll tune into some of the right-wingers to hear what they're talking about.
Yeah. I have found that conservatives are less likely to want to listen to a liberal than liberals are likely to listen to a conservative, which also, I think, helps
exactly.
The conservatives. I've noticed that personally, and we've also done research that backs that up to a certain degree in terms of being measurable. Why do you think progressive radio works so well? I guess I'm getting into a little bit of a subjective determination here on NPR or on public radio. Why the conservatives claim that public radio is liberally biased. So part one of that question is, do you agree with that? And two, if it is even more liberal than conservative commercial talk radio, why do you think it works so successfully on the non-commercial side of radio?
First of all, I know from my own experience listening and appearing on public radio that it does not lean left. I mean, if there's anything today that is really right down the middle, I would say it's the PBS NewsHour and it is NPR with all of its programming, whether it's Morning Edition or All Things Considered or a show that I do often called Here and Now. But again, I think it works because it gets that vast middle, which certainly right-wing talk radio does not appeal to, because it would have some different voices on it. And then I think it gets to those on the progressive side who really want to hear all points of view and then make up their own mind. They don't want to be spoon-fed, right? They don't want to hear, if you will, talking points or packaged political philosophy from either side. So I think it's a format that's successful and that maybe appeals to the more educated among the American populace. But I know it's real. I have to tell you, I get more response when I go on NPR from just people around the country, right, the texts and emails, mm-hmm. than I do when I go on CNN or MSNBC.
That doesn't surprise me. And I have also noticed when I'm interviewed on a public radio show, I get more feedback than I do when I appear anywhere else, because I do talking head stuff on TV, and I do a lot of a lot of interviews on commercial talk radio. But whenever I'm on NPR, it's amazing that people come up and say, "I heard you on the radio." One of the things that amazes me, Bill, is how you can hide in plain sight nowadays in any media and have nobody notice it. I mean, you could go on the biggest station, or you could have an article in the biggest newspaper, and back in the day, everybody would know about it. Have you noticed today how hard it is sometimes to get any attention, even if you're out there on big platforms?
Yes, indeed. And I'll tell you where, again, get it on NPR. The other place is, let's face it, it's social media today. Mm-hmm. Social media rules today. Michael, when I made my announcement about that I was at the end of the month going to have my last daily show and move into a podcast, where did I turn? Right? I didn't go to the Washington Post or New York Times or whatever to make an announcement. I called friends at Politico Playbook, and that Mike Allen with Axios and Politico Playbook, they're read by everybody who pays attention to the media or to politics. And, I mean, everybody's exaggeration, but they're huge. And that's where people get the news today.
Mm-hmm. And it goes back to what we were saying before about audiences have to be built brick by brick. There's no such thing as casting a wide net and bringing in whatever comes into the net, you know, from that mass appeal, mm-hmm. that thing we used to call the American people or the public or mass appeal. These terms have a very different meaning here in the first quarter of the 21st century than they did back in the day when most of the people who were still operating in the media began. And that was, of course, the ancient old country called the 20th century. Let's
you know, Michael, yeah. I was thinking while we were talking, I remember here in Washington, D.C., we had a little cocktail reception to celebrate Ed Schultz when he got on number 100 station, mm-hmm. right? He was on 100 stations. How many progressive stations are there today? You would know better than I. But
a handful.
There are a handful.
A handful. As somebody who cares about the medium of talk radio in a non-ideological way, that frustrates me because I do think there's the potential to do better than that. Oh, but whatever. Go ahead.
And at the same time, though, there are many people, millions of people, who do listen to progressive podcasts.
Yes.
So that's the good side. That's the encouraging side. And knowing that is why that's where I should focus.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. What you're doing makes total sense. I just I'm recognizing the fact that we are still operating at a time, you know, it's only 2019. Think about 1919. In 1919, most of the artifacts, tenets, culture of the 20th century had yet to develop. It still was very much like the 19th century. It wasn't until the 30s and 40s that you really started to see what we consider the modern world that we grew up in starting to take shape. And I think that we're still very much in that blended area where if people were to come back from 100 years from now, they wouldn't know if we're in the 20th century or the 21st century. We still have that much going. And radio is still a viable business. It's still an industry. There's a lot of money invested in it. Yep. Millions of people listen to it. So I don't want to throw it out completely. And even when industries are in decline, a lot of money and a lot of impact and influence could be, you know, manifested if you do it properly. Sometimes I get frustrated. Yeah. It looks as if sometimes the ownership of mainstream radio is doing everything it can to hasten its decline as opposed to, you know, put a stop on it. But that's a whole other deal, I guess. You know, any thoughts?
Yes. And you and I have seen that, and I regret it as well. By the way, I should add that one thing, and I feel a little guilty here because I cannot give the whole story, but when I say I'm moving to a podcast, it's going to be more than one podcast. Mm-hmm. One I'm going to be doing myself once a week, but I'm also going to be starting the first week of June or maybe the first week of July doing a podcast every week with a prominent national figure And I'll announce, we can't announce that for a couple of weeks. But I will, Michael, I will call you and make sure that you get the news when we announce.
That's great. A prominent figure.
It's going to be very exciting.
Okay.
Very exciting. Major, prominent national figure.
Okay, right. Cool. All right. Well, we look forward to that. And that should be interesting. So you're starting your whole brand of podcasts as opposed to.
Exactly.
And yep. There's no reason.
Right.
There's no reason not to, because, wonderful things about the new media is there's not that much restriction. The restrictions are only the ones you put on yourself and in terms of your will and your energy. There's no end to how many channels any brand, and we'll use that word, can generate. Let's go back now to something we talked about earlier, and that was you were talking about the 24-plus candidates running for the Democratic presidential nomination.
Right.
And how there's something for everybody, that it's a smorgasbord. You know, there's black, there's white, there's gay, there's women, there's the old school, the new school. Is there a danger for somebody that vehemently believes that we must, you know, remove Donald Trump from office one way or the other, and this election is the chance to do it? Is there the danger that it's too fractionalized, that the fact there are so many candidates and there's the identity politics, there's the specificity of what each of them wants, that only one person and a running mate will be able to face Donald Trump in 2020? Is there the danger that it'll be too narrow and too far away from the mass, whatever the masses are today in that election, and it could wind up costing the Democrats the victory?
I don't believe so at all. I hear that from some people. I just totally reject that for a couple of reasons.
Hmm.
First of all, let's say, why are there so many candidates running? Okay, I think there are two reasons. One is because since 2016, the idea that you had to have certain amount of expertise and experience and qualifications to make it to the Oval Office, that seems so quaint today, right, after Donald Trump. I mean, a lot of people do feel, hey, if that clown could make it, I could make it, right?
Hmm.
But I think more importantly, what it shows, the multiplicity of candidates, is this energy, a tremendous energy on the left that we saw in 2018, where there were more, particularly women, more women volunteering, more women donating, more women running for office, more women voting than ever before. I mean, there's a huge amount of more political energy than I'd certainly seen since 1968 in the anti-war protests. And it was mainly on the left. And look at what it resulted in, 40 new seats in the House of Representatives. So I think all of that energy is really good for the Democratic Party. It's a multiplicity of ideas that are coming out, dealing with free college tuition and dealing with climate change and dealing with breaking up maybe some of the, not that I agree with all of these, right, but there's so many new ideas, getting rid of the Electoral College, expanding the Supreme Court, they go on and on. I mean, this is a very yeasty time, which I think is very healthy. And the other reason I'm not worried is because, look, in the end, it still takes a certain amount of resources to make it to the nomination. Not all of these 24 candidates are going to, first of all, they won't all make it on the debate stage, number one.
Mm-hmm.
I believe after the first debate, there'll be several candidates drop out. After the second debate, there will be more. I think we'll end up with a max of like maybe half a dozen, six or eight candidates. But all of these candidates are making their contribution, and let them do so as long as they can last, and then they'll drop out and support somebody else. And final point, that here's what I find that unites all Democrats. And by the way, I heard from a very, very good friend of mine in California today, who's one of the biggest donors in the Democratic Party. I'll mention her name, Susie Tompkins Buell, very, very close friend of Hillary's. And she told me she's supporting four candidates, Jay Inslee, Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, and Pete Buttigieg.
Hmm.
Now, she's supporting four different candidates, right? Because here's what I think, most Democrats are looking for. They don't care whether it's male or female, white or black or gay or straight. They want the candidate who can beat Donald Trump.
Mm.
And we don't know who that candidate is right yet. I think a lot of people are feeling it could be Joe Biden, because that's why he's doing so well in the polls. But if he is, that's the only reason, because they're looking for the one who is solid, and they can count trust to beat Donald Trump.
Yeah.
So in the end, I think all these choices add up to that and give people more confidence that they've had a lot of choices, they've looked them all over, but they're going to end up with the one that they think is the strongest.
Of all the candidates, the one that harkens back to a mass appeal type candidate and a traditional candidate is Biden. I notice you didn't mention his name in the four that she selected to help.
Right.
What is your personal feeling about Biden's chances of surviving 23 or more other candidates attacking him while he's trying to attack Donald Trump and maintaining his luster through the rigors of 2 years of campaigning ahead?
Well, first of all, we know let me start pause. I've been very impressed by the first couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks of the Biden campaign so far. Like others, I thought that he had peaked before he got in, and once he got in, the sniping would start and people would just start looking at the Iraq war, the Anita Hill thing, the touching little mini scandal, and his numbers will start to fall. But he has, he's been gaffe-free so far. He has, I think his message is very strong, a message of unity, getting America back on track, and that Donald Trump does not represent who we are. He has made it a general election strategy from the beginning. Donald Trump has helped him immensely. He can't stop talking about Joe Biden, and so that makes people see it almost now as a general election matchup. I would just have to say right now, if I had to bet of the 24 which candidate will persevere and emerge as a Democratic nominee, it would be Joe Biden. That could change. But I think all that experience shows, Michael. You know, he knows what he's got to do, what he's got to say, and keep it under control. And again, I've been very impressed so far.
Final question.
That's not an endorsement, by the way.
I hear you loud and clear. Now, you've been clear in presenting an objective view of your opinion strategically as it stands 2 years before the election, duly noted. Final question. You are one of the pioneers of talk media debate. You're on one of the great shows, Crossfire. And you've, as we've mentioned earlier, you have survived and are active in talk media through a number of decades and thus a number of eras. How has, from your perspective, the art of public debate changed from those days when you were on Crossfire to the way debate in politics is carried out in the media today?
I'm sad to say that I think the practice or art, if you want to use it, of political debate as we see it today on television has sunk to an all-time low. I think that I'm proud of the work that we did on Crossfire. And it wasn't just Crossfire, but Crossfire was the first. And we took one issue for a half an hour and had good people on to talk about both sides of that issue. And I think we informed people, we entertained people, and we left it basically up to the audience to decide. And in 6 years that I was on Crossfire, up against people who became good friends, Bob Novak, Pat Buchanan, Mary Madeline, Tucker Carlson. In 6 years, there was only two times when it got personal to the point where we just had to stop after the show and say, whoop, that went over the line, shouldn't do it. Twice in all of those shows. Today, it is nothing but personal. It is ugly. It gets mean and nasty. And I think it's a great public disservice, what cable television particularly has done to political debate. And I regret that.
And there you have it, a conversation with Bill Press. To learn more about Bill Press, his new podcasts and his books, visit BillPressShow.com or follow him on Twitter, where his address is @BPShow. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, and the Podcast One app, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's @MHInterview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. The Michael Harrison Interview. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Interview is a presentation of Podcast One, produced in association with Talkers Magazine and Good Phone Communications. Copyright 2019, all rights reserved.